Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and Adam Barrett's on the line. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Fred.
You were baiting me last week. You sent me an email asking me what I thought about some industry standard. I'm not even sure who put it out. It was SAE or ASME, or I don't remember what organization put the standard out. But you gave me this very, I almost deleted it because it had very little in it. And it said, what do you think of this?
Or that was something. Very much on purpose. I didn't want to give you any lead in to help you agree or disagree.
Okay. So it was some industry standard, and it was on, I think, allocating confidence intervals, or I think my comment back to you was, this is pure BS. And I had no idea what your take on it was. And it turned out, it was a weird standard, but it was an industry standard. It had all the trappings of, you know, the backing of that professional society. It had a committee that worked on it and reviewed it probably. It had all this stuff that made it look official, but it was pretty much worthless, in my opinion, for any use of any practical merit.
Oh, definitely. I totally agree. Now, we promised ourselves we'd find a topic to argue on, because we know that the more fun episodes are when we argue. Mm-hmm. But I also thought it was total crap. And I wanted to see what you thought, if you thought it was crap, or if you were like, no, this is the merit. And I was, you know, to see if I missed it. But I actually laughed out loud when I read the conclusion in that standard, or, you know, the summary, because I almost feel like they put in the outs, so that to give them an out of if people disagree with it, or something goes wrong with it, or it doesn't do what it's supposed to do, they almost confessed in it. The way it was written, it was just kind of obvious to me that it wasn't as solid as it could be. But nonetheless, they also within there captured how there was such a strong need for this to be done this way, you know, where necessity drives sometimes can drive the existence of something.
Yeah. Well, it brings up the question is, well, how should we use industry standards from a reliability?
Now we got the material for the argument.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break here and we'll come back in a second.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett of Apex Ridge Reliability. Apex Ridge Reliability is an engineering consulting service that advances your product development with reliability tools, methods, cultural practices, and education to ensure you create mature and reliable products. To learn more, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/apex.
All right. Now, Adam, I think there's a storm brewing between us on this one. So industry standards have a role. There's all kinds of them. There's standards that say, here's a procedure to run a test, doing calibration on a piece of equipment, right?
Wait a second. Wait. During that break, I grabbed a weapon. I assumed you did too. I grabbed like a Nerf gun. What did you get?
I've got my microphone. I'm good. We're leaving standards pretty broad right here. So part of it is there's standards that say, here's how you conduct a test. Right. Here's how to tell if your chamber is set at the degree temperature that you actually think it's set at, and so on. And then there's standards for how to interpret those results, how to calculate sample sizes, for example, or design a test. And then there's standards for design characteristics. These are strengths of bolts, for example, that you need to use in certain applications. There's standards for how to measure light intensity. And there's standards for everything. In the reliability world, there's standards that include how to create a reliability plan, how to define availability, how to conduct an environmental test, or check a package if it will survive shipping for land transport, for example. Now, you got to admit, Adam, that some of those are useful. And some of them are not.
Well, let's talk about what's the intent of creating a standard in a philosophical sense. Why do standards exist?
It's so standards bodies and professional societies can make money. That's been my opinion all along.
Oh, boy.
No, I made a little tongue-in-cheek there, but IEC is just a profit-making center. I'm sorry. They make all these international standards.
Yeah.
And they're $100 a piece, and you can't buy just one because you're required to buy six of them to answer one question. It's ridiculous.
No, I agree. I agree it's abused. But going back to the origins of it before it was abused, why? What's a reason that if the standards didn't exist and somebody wanted to start discussing, you know, describing what they are and they wanted to do it, what's a reason you could see them giving as to why we need it?
Well, yeah, it goes, I mean, in the English measurement system, we have a foot, right? And legend is, or at least the way I understood it, was that there was a debate over what's a unit of measure of length. And so somebody says, I'm going to sell you something certain length, and they didn't have a term to define it. So the king said, use the size of my foot. So it's 1 foot. And it was roughly the same for everybody. So if you pace something out, 8 feet was about that long. And right. It gave a convenient metric or measure to discuss length. And then it went into time. It went into all kinds of things. As we needed a common language to talk about distance, length, weight, value, all kinds of things. So I think standard is been evolved as our language has evolved to deal with commerce to a large degree. I don't know. Does that make sense? Why we have standards?
So you were describing it from the aspect of creating a way for people to communicate, you know, to advance communication, right? Mm-hmm. So that without a doubt, yeah, is a core reason of it. Another reason being is that people don't have to reinvent things that have been established as valid by professional committee, right? There is value to that. In the sense of, I'm not expert in something, but if I go to the standard, I can execute this, and these results, if I base a decision on, are considered valid per this, you know, agreed upon method. So yeah, those are two ways that it's...
Well, that's where I see it starts to get fuzzy in its usefulness, though.
Exactly. So now that leaves it very open to, you know, who's in charge, right? And, you know, and then at that point you can charge, you know, as you described, there's ways that can go sideways. So it means you can't abolish or abandon standards entirely, but it also means you need to still can't blindly accept them, right? So we're trying to discuss and figure out that area in between.
Right.
Do you want to hear a funny side story? Is that I found out why America is on the English system, why we're one of the only countries not on the metric system.
Is it Washington, D.C.'s fault?
Pirates.
Pirates?
Freaking pirates, yeah. If it wasn't for pirates, I wouldn't have two sets of every tool I own. So I have an English and a metric one, and it's stupid pirates, yeah.
Really?
Yep. When France was... You know, the French, I forget these people's names, but two French dudes decided to establish the metric system. And they had the way they did it is they went around and they said, this is 1 kilogram. You know, they had a mass, and they said, this is 1 meter. And they had a very specific length piece of rod. And they went around with those two simple pieces of metal around the other countries and said, you know, will you adopt a system based on these two things? Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, yep, totally makes sense. It's scalable by 10, the whole thing.
Right.
So they had a third dude that they gave those to, and they sent him over on a ship to America because this was when some of our original founding fathers were actually still doing legislation. And I forgot which one it was. But anyway, they had communicated, and one, I don't know which founding father it was, maybe Benjamin Franklin or what, but, he was like, yeah, this is important for us to get written up in our things now. And, a storm had diverted the ship, to the Caribbean. They kind of turned farther south because the storm was hammering them, and they got taken over by pirates and looted, and those two pieces, you know, standards were stolen. So the French dudes were like, all right, let's do it again. So they took another guy and they gave him two more hunks of metal. And he went over, and by the time he got over, we had already officially in law accepted the, you know, what is the English system as our standards.
Well, wasn't there a big push in the 70s to go metric? I remember learning about it in school and stuff. Were there pirates around then that thwarted that event? Or
probably, you know, I bet you there were I think they're called lobbyists now.
Oh, yeah, yeah, same thing. Yeah,
so, because I remember the speed signs that were, you know, both in kilometers per hour and miles per hour in the 70s. But I bet you somebody lobbied or something. Somebody was going to lose money or could gain to make money by, it's probably the conversion people, whoever makes money on conversions or something.
That's right, yeah. But this, we get faced with, and I've had a client that came in once and asked about, well, we're making this wrist electronics that fit on your wrist, and they measure a bunch of stuff. And what standard should we use to make sure that it's accepted in the market? Well,
it's accepted.
Yeah. I mean, you can get UL acceptance, but nobody's going to care. You know, UL probably doesn't know how to evaluate it.
You mean for safety? Is that right. What you're talking
about? No, it was for what standard should we use? And so I think I've talked about this story before, is they wanted to make it water resistant so that people could wash their hands or do sporting activities and they could get wet and it would be all right. They wanted to demonstrate by passing a standard that it was water resistant. And I thought, you know, that's a reasonable way to use standards. Use it as a proof of, to the market, that you, it's like the good housekeeping seal of approval. If I get some international standard and we pass that test, every customer doesn't have to prove it to themselves. They can use it as a little bit of acceptance that if that standard is okay, then I'm okay with it. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, in the sense that now words have meaning though, right? Because if you don't have a standard for what water resistant means, really you could write it on anything. So now the word has meaning if it's associated to something that we all specifically know means I can, you know,
we could replicate this test. We could go,
right,
you know, go check it. So,
well, it's not even go check it. It's price comparison, right? In one sense for me, because there'll be an option out there that is full on waterproof, right? But right. It, you know, where I can swim with it. But it'll cost two times more. And there'll be another one that'll say water resistant that's only, you know, it's half the price or whatever. And so if I believe water resistant means that I can get it wet in the rain or under the sink, I'm like, well, that's good enough for me. I can take it off when I swim. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I need to know that that's what it means. Otherwise, if the water resistant means that I can just, you know, it can deal with high humidity in the air, then I do want to spend twice as much and get the waterproof one that's not going to, you know, break in the rain. So
right.
the words have meaning if you create a standard associated to a term.
Right. So here's where I have the hardest time with the liberal use of the desire to use standards. And I find the problem to be people want to use the standards, not so that they can use somebody else's process or the credibility or all those things. It's so they don't have to think through the problem. So this same team that I'm talking about, is they used the standard from the watch industry that defined water resistance to different depths. And it was, I think, 3 feet or 6 feet or a meter, 2 meters, so on. And they didn't ever, the standard never went to waterproof, because you get enough pressure on it, water is going to get in pretty much anything. It'll diffuse through materials. But the watch industry had one for 3 meters. And the test was you basically put the device in 3 meters depth of water for 30 seconds and you pull it out, shake off the excess moisture and see if it works. And if it works, it's waterproof. It's or water resistant. It passes that test. And so they did that and they had 10 samples and they all passed and they said, all right, great. And they handed it off to the marketing team. There were claim water resistance, saw all the photos and ads with it all wet and things like that. And watches use a metal encapsulant and seal. They have the experience that test doesn't really buy them anything. They went way beyond what that simple test could do. to create watches that they put into the marketplace. Whereas these guys learned the hard way that water that seeps into connectors and diffuses through polymers stays inside and creates corrosion that takes a week before it occurs. And a mechanical watch doesn't suffer from corrosion in quite the same way as an electronic circuit. And so they, most of their products failed pretty quickly, but the standard was only dunk it in water and test it. It wasn't wait a week. And so the failure mechanism was fundamentally different, and it wasn't explained in the standard. It just said for watches, and it could be a, you know, a mechanical watch or electrical watch or whatever. It didn't specify what mechanisms, what devices, what kind of enclosures, anything like that, what the conditions or constraints were. And I see that in a lot of standards. They say, oh, if you put it in 85 degrees C at 85 RH for 100 hours, it's good. Well, good for what?
So the laziness you're talking about is people not taking the time to see if what the standard was driven by applies to their situation. And I agree. I see that a lot because it's very easy to do. And that's where, you know, standards can get a bad name because of the misapplication. So, you know, I guess kind of what you're pointing out is that every standard should have a reference as to what went into and was considered in creating it, you know, which is probably hard to find if it's even able to be found.
Yeah. And I've resorted to actually, you know, contacting people that are listed in the creation of the standard. And oftentimes it's one or two people that had it, something they did developed internally to their own company and wanted to create a standard for it. So they didn't have to meet a different standard. Others were created as kind of the lowest common denominator. We need something, and here's something we can all agree on, but it's bare minimum. Others are, you could buy a textbook for hypothesis testing, which would be a whole lot less expensive than buying international standards on how to calculate the results of a hypothesis test. Some of it, you know, some standards are used in contracting language. Thou shalt meet these standards, that kind of stuff. But it's, I think it's in the reliability world, it's, there's too many changes in our materials and our processes in the way we invent and assemble things that failure mechanisms changed. You know, what caused the electronics component to fail at, and it was relevant for a high temperature humidity test in the 70s is completely different than it is today, given the changes in materials and encapsulants and assembly processes that we have today. So that test in the old days meant that a product would likely last for 5 years. Today, it likely doesn't mean that. It means something completely different. It might last 50 years or it might last 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. And yet I see that standard test profile in industry after industry and in test after test. And people just say, well, we're doing 85-85 and now we're good.
Right.
No,
right.
You're not.
Yeah. And it's exactly. That's also misapplication of what we're talking about, the different reasons for standards. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to make a statement about your product specifically, a standard's not the first place you turn for all the reasons we just said of how specific any individual product even used in a different application is. Mm-hmm. And you want to make a statement about it because reliability is not, it's not just, you know, that a reliability statement itself requires use case, environment, and time period.
Right.
So if any one of those three is different, the use case is different, the environment's different, time period's different, you know, you no longer can make the same statement. So the idea of turning to a standard to make a reliability statement like that is 99% of the time not going to end up being truthful. So yeah, I mean, its primary use is to be used as an anchor for, you know, comparison and, you know, validation. But yeah, you have to make sure you're within that category that it was created for, and all the same assumptions apply.
Yeah. And well, maybe after we get rid of MTBF, then I'll go after cleaning up standards because there's we have way too many standards that just don't tell you the constraints or where this applies.
Yeah.
And I think that's doing the standards industry a disservice. So are there any standards that are actually useful? If any you'd point to say, yep, I would use that one?
But that's an abstract, that question unto itself is flawed, because the question really is, you know, to say they're useful, they can be useful and unuseful. Any individual standard can be useful or not useful based on application.
Right.
That was my point. It's the application. So you can't say any specific standard is useful or not useful. It's very likely it was created for a very specific reason and it's useful in that very specific application. It's the misuse of it, which is very common, that makes it not useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of my favorite standards, and I use it. Not to put on a data sheet and pass all those tests, but the MIL standard 810 is a listing of all kinds of different environmental stresses. And instead of running all those tests and you know the ones that are relevant for our use case, I use it as an idea of what range of stresses could apply. So if I, like in an FMEA, I'll pull out that list and say, all right, how does temperature affect this product? How does vibration affect this product? How does fungus affect this product? How does mold affect this product? How does dust and blowing sand affect this, and so on? It becomes a nice checklist of relevant stresses that affect products' performances. And then it's always, and what else? What else can affect this thing? So I use it as a touchstone. But if somebody says, well, yeah, dust is a problem, we need to be concerned with it, how do we evaluate that? How do we get more information? Well, the details in 810 include, well, how do you test for dust exposure? Mm. But it still takes the thinking, is this relevant exactly for our application?
Well, that's the difference. The way you described, you used it, where it's a piece of information for your investigation and evaluation. That's mm-hmm. great. It just can't be the follow it to the letter checkbox, yes or no, things went well, and that's when it goes wrong, right? Mm-hmm, so,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I should hazard the guess of, have you gotten involved with regulatory compliance type testing at all?
Well, you mean what? Well, I mean, not a lot, because that's kind of a very standardized thing. There's not a lot of investigation in that. So there's people that are certified to, like, I'm not certified to give any regulatory pre-approval or to be a part of the approval process, because mm-hmm. that's just somebody who's just set up to run that.
Yeah. What I've tried over the years to take a look at the regulatory testing that we had to do. And there's all kinds of different things that different countries and different entities require. And some of those actually look at stresses that apply to reliability. The regulatory guys may say only expose it to the stress for 100 hours and give us the results. Where I'm going to say, well, if we've got 10 units under those stresses, let's keep them running until we get some more useful information. So sometimes the procedures of applying the stresses make sense. But I mostly find that those regulatory requirements, like you said, are they're more on the legal side. We got to do this to meet these requirements to get into this market, which is a condition of doing business in many parts of the world. Most of them that I found are just don't make a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So it's been bit and pieces of those I can pull out. But I think that's another whole realm, and I touch it with a 10-foot pole and try to keep it away from what I'm doing, unless I can see an overlap where we can leverage some samples, for example.
Yeah. Well, it's smart use, right? It's just, it's another thing to reference in your intelligent investigation. Intelligent investigation being the key words there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it might be actually a theme that we talk about quite often, is you need to think this stuff through, whether it's creating a reliability plan or bridging some gaps or responding to your customers, doing field failure analysis, any of those things. You need to bring your thinking part of your brain along to do it. So I guess not a lot of disagreement there. We tried.
Yeah, it's disappointing. We got to fight about something. I think we've been hanging out together too long. We're starting like an old married couple. We just start to become alike.
Yeah.
Do we look alike? We don't look alike.
Well, I'm hoping to look more like you. That'd be an improvement for me.
So. Well, oh my God, now you're flattering me. So now only are we not arguing, you're flattering me. This is ridiculous.
All right. Well, we'll leave it to our listeners. You know, first off, be careful how you use standards. If you're just using it because a customer told you to use it, it may take a little thinking to figure out how to get some productive information out of that process. You might still have to do the standard the way it's written to appease your customer, that you may be able to leverage that to actually get something meaningful or useful out of it. In general, you got to think through what we do for reliability work and testing and so on. And standards are a piece of information. They're not the end game. But also let us know, head over to reliability.fm. You can find the Speaking of Reliability show and a handful of other podcasts. But let us know in the comments or send us a message of what you would like to hear about. Join the discussion. You know, how do you use standards, and what obstacles do you have to using them well? That might be a good topic. And let us know your thoughts or ideas, and we'll continue the discussion on it. So with that, Adam, I think... we put the standards to bed here, to speak.
Yep. Always comes back to my intent. A lot of my arguments come back to intent. So.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good way to phrase it. All right. Well, thanks, Adam. Talk to you again.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.